All right, we're going to get this meeting started at 2:04 p.m. Please, clerk, please call the roll.
Thank you. Councilmember Kaplan will be absent this afternoon. Councilmember Dickinson.
Here.
Councilmember Pluckiebaum. Councilmember Maple.
Here.
Mayor Pro Tem Garrow will be absent this afternoon. Councilmember Jennings.
Here.
Councilmember Vang.
Here.
Mayor McCarty will be absent this afternoon. And Mayor Pro, excuse me, Vice Mayor Talamontes.
Here.
You have a quorum.
Thank you. And Councilmember Jennings, please lead us in the acknowledgement and pledge of allegiance.
Please rise for the opening acknowledgements in honor of Sacramento's indigenous people and tribal lands. To the original people of this land, the Nisian people, the Southern Maidu, the Valley and Plains Miwok, and the Putnam Wintum peoples, and the people of the Wilton Rancheria, Sacramento's only federally recognized tribe, may we acknowledge and honor the Native people who came before us and still walk beside us today on these ancestral lands by choosing to gather together today in active practice and acknowledgement and appreciation for Sacramento's indigenous people's history, their contributions, and their lives. Thank you. Please join me in the Pledge of Allegiance. Salute. I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Thank you so much. All right, moving along to consent calendar. Do we have any members that would like to pull anything or comment on anything?
Vice Mayor, I do have a read into the record. Item number 4 is going to be withdrawn from this agenda, and we'll bring it back at a later date.
Okay, thank you. Seeing no comments, questions, I need a motion and a second on the consent calendar.
Motion to move the consent calendar.
All right, all right, we have a motion and a second. Clerk, please call the roll.
Thank you. That was
Is there any public comment on this?
There's no public comment on this. We have a motion by Councilmember Jennings and a second by Dickinson. Did you want to do roll call or a voice vote?
Voice vote is fine.
Thank you. All in favor, say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Abstain? That motion passes.
All right, moving along. Public hearings, item number 13.
Good afternoon. My name is Ebony Heaven, Human Resources Manager in the Employment, Classification, and Development Division, also known as ECD, of the Human Resources Department. In accordance with Assembly Bill 2561, I am here to present on the city's recruitment, retention, and vacancy efforts for 2024. I know that the date selected for this presentation is later than you would have liked. In the future, we will bring our vacancy reports earlier in the year. Today's presentation will offer a comprehensive overview of the legislative requirements, a data-driven analysis of the city's vacancy trends, and an in-depth look at our recruitment and retention strategies, and a discussion of key factors influencing our ability to attract and retain talent. Assembly Bill 2561, signed into law in 2024, requires publicly report on staffing vacancies, recruitment efforts, and retention strategies prior to the adoption of their annual budget. The legislation aims to increase transparency and accountability in the public sector hiring. If a bargaining unit's vacancy rate meets or exceeds 20% for full-time positions, the agency must, upon request from the employee organization, provide additional details such as the number of vacancies, applicant volume, hiring timelines, and steps taken to improve working conditions or compensation. The law also ensures that employee organizations have the opportunity to present their perspectives during the public hearing should they make a request to do so. As such, upon conclusion of this presentation today, you will hear from one bargaining unit, Sacramento Area Firefighters, Local 522. While it will provide data on the city's vacancies rate, it's equally important to understand why vacancies exist. There are several legitimate reasons why positions remain vacant for extended periods. In many cases, departments intentionally leave certain roles unfilled to generate vacancy savings. These savings are often strategically redirected to support critical operational needs, such as equipment purchases, infrastructure improvements, temporary staffing, and one-time project costs without requiring additional budget allocations. This practice allows departments to address pressing priorities while maintaining fiscal responsibility. Additionally, ongoing recruitment challenges have significantly impacted the city's ability to fill certain positions. Labor shortages across both the public and private sectors, especially for technical, specialized, and high-demand roles, have made it increasingly difficult to attract qualified candidates. Despite repeated recruitment efforts, the applicants' pool may be limited or insufficient, particularly for competitive labor markets for positions requiring advanced certifications, licensing, or experience. In some cases, the perception of long-term vacancies may be inflated due to internal administrative practices. For example, departments often reuse the most recent vacant position number to hire staff into roles or functional areas, rather than reactivating or locating older, more appropriate position numbers. This can create the impression that the position has been vacant for many years, even though the work is being done somewhere else or under a different functional area. It's also important to emphasize that a vacant position does not equate to an unnecessary one. In many instances, the duties associated with the unfilled role are temporarily distributed amongst existing staff, or the position is held open while the department reassesses its workforce needs. Recruitment may be delayed as departments evaluate whether the classification is still appropriate, whether reorganization is warranted, or whether marketing conditions may improve. These are not signs of inefficiency or neglect, rather they reflect strategic decision-making tailored to current operational demands. Vacant positions are also subject to routine review. During the annual budget process and through internal evaluation, departments assess whether each vacancy remains relevant. If a position is determined to no longer serve the needs of the department, it may be reclassified or eliminated during the budget process. This ensures that staffing decisions are based on forward-thinking analysis of departmental needs rather than on arbitrary timelines. Typically, the vacancy report would not address sweeping of vacancies, but I know that's a consideration for council during this budget cycle. Sweeping all positions could have serious unintended consequences. These include diminished service levels, increased workload for remaining staff, loss of capacity to implement important initiatives, and a reduction in the city's ability to respond flexibly to evolving community needs. Every vacancy has context, and each one is reviewed through the lens of current and future operational needs. Lastly, long-term vacancies should not be viewed solely as budget liability. Rather, they are often the result of careful strategic planning in response to resource constraints, market realities, and operational transitions. Eliminating them without thorough evaluation could undermine departmental effectiveness and limit the city's ability to adapt to future challenges. Vacancy by data bargaining unit is displayed for your review. Auto Marine and Specialty Painters Local 1176 and International Association of Machinists and Aerospace Workers, IAMAW, were the only two bargaining units with a vacancy rate at or above 20% for 2024. In accordance with AB 2561, representatives of all bargaining units were both notified of today's public hearing on May 9, 2025. A representative from IAMAW planned to attend today's presentation. However, the bargaining unit's representative notified me this morning they would be unable to attend due to an unexpected emergency. Local 1176 responding, acknowledging receipt of the notice, but was unable to attend the meeting. This chart represents vacancy data for part-time and unrepresented employees. It's important to note that vacancy rates for Local 39 part-time and non-career positions remain high, in part because many of these roles are seasonal and filled on an as-needed basis to support parks programs and convention and cultural services events. This slide highlights the city's vacancy rates for 2024 across different employee groups. While we see higher vacancy rates in part-time and unrepresented positions as mentioned above, at 37% and 29% respectively, the citywide vacancy rate for all positions sits at 18%. Notably, the vacancy rate for full-time represented positions is relatively low at 14%, reflecting strong staffing stability in our core workforce. This slide provides citywide recruitment data as well as recruitment data for Local 1176 and IAMAW. This information is pulled from the city's applicant tracking system, NeoGov. I like to point out that NeoGov's reporting capabilities are not as sophisticated as the reporting capabilities of our HRIS system. As such, much of the data provided required a manual effort to provide. As you can see from the data provided, the average time to hire beginning from the first date of the job posting varies. However, this number takes into account various factors, including lengthy performance examinations included as part of the recruitment process, postings that are open and continuous, meaning the posting continuously accepts applications until the vacancies are filled, the time it takes for departments to identify who they would like to include in the interview process, lengthy interview processes conducted by city personnel, the offer process, and the time that it takes for candidates to complete any pre-employment requirements for the position. Please note that a candidate has approximately 30 days to complete any pre-employment requirements. The traffic engineering unit, represented by Local 1176, is our smallest unit in the city. The unit includes only 16 budgeted positions and 4 classifications: traffic worker trainee and traffic workers 1, 2, and 3. Ultimately, with small units, it is easy to meet or exceed 20% vacancy rate with just a few vacancies. These classifications in these units are currently only used in a public works department and are often filled through flexible staffing practices. Just as an FYI, flexible staffing allows current employees to promote within the series without going through the competitive recruitment process, provided they meet the established policy requirements. While the data presented reflects the status as of December 31st, 2024, as of today, May 27, 2025, there are only 4 current vacancies in this unit, making their current vacancy rate 25%, down from 44% in 2024. There is currently 1 open job posting for the traffic worker 2 classification and no requisition submitted to human resources for the other classifications in the city to initiate a recruitment to fill the remaining vacancies. The automotive and equipment mechanics unit, represented by IAMAW, is our second smallest unit in the city with only 69 budgeted positions. The unit consists of 9 classifications used across multiple departments citywide. Similarly, although the data provided is based on figures for 2024, as of today, there are 14 current vacancies in this unit, making their vacancy rate down to 20%, down 9% from 2024. There are no current job postings, no requisitions submitted to human resources to fill these positions either. While it would be ideal to provide the most recent vacancy data for all units, the cutoff date was December 31st so that we could reconcile a full year's worth of vacancy data versus the data for recruitments. Displayed, you'll see the full life cycle for the recruitment process to better understand the many complexities of the city's recruitment process, and that the process can vary depending on the need for a civil service examination. For 2024, the Employment Classification Development Division reviewed and processed 843 requisitions, created and oversaw 514 job postings, processed 41,895 applications, created 843 eligible lists to send to city departments to fill vacancies, and processed 2,587 hire, rehire, promotions, and transfer personnel actions for full-time and part-time positions. Now, let's take a look at the other side of retention and explore departures as well. The data presented reflects a breakdown of these 1,640 employee departures from city positions in 2024. Internal promotions and transfers resulted in 34% of the total departures, illustrating strong internal mobility within the organization, a strong commitment to career growth, and continued service within our organization. Voluntary separations accounted for 886 departures, of which 703 were for part-time non-career positions, which, as discussed earlier, are hired for seasonal needs, followed by 143 retirements. This snapshot offers an insight into the various reasons for workforce transition and highlights the importance of retention efforts as part of the city's overall workforce strategy. The city's retention rate for 2024 was 92%. This metric helps us to assess our ability to retain staff over time and can be a useful indicator for workforce stability, employee engagement, and overall organizational health. The city's retention rate as of today, beginning January 1st, 2025, is 98%. Since 2018, Human Resources has made significant policy improvements and developed a robust set of resources to support city departments, and it has both the applicant and employee experience. This includes, but is not limited to, the creation of recruitment, selection, and hiring manual, which sets forth guidelines for hiring authorities to provide a fair and consistent approach to the recruitment, selection, and hiring process. The internal and external recruitment and hiring policy, which establishes guidelines for filling vacancies, and a vast number of resources provided on the human or the employment and applicant resources page for the general public and on Nexus, the city's internet site for departmental use. While DEI may not be the primary focus of today's presentation, it's important to acknowledge that diversity, equity, and inclusion must remain foundational to all workforce practices, particularly as we work to attract and retain top talent. Significant changes in the labor market have reshaped how individuals engage with work, and employees now have more options than ever before. In this environment, our ability to remain competitive depends on creating a workplace culture where people feel a sense of belonging, opportunity, and purpose. As the city expands its reach through flexible work arrangements and modernized recruitment efforts, embedding DEI into our hiring, onboarding, and retention strategies is not just a value statement, but it's business imperative. Cultivating an inclusive culture is essential to sustaining a dynamic, high-performing workforce that reflects and serves our diverse community. Significant changes in the labor market have noticeably influenced the number of applicants, hires, and employee retention within our organization. This competitive labor market has also heightened the challenges of retaining diverse talent, as employees now have more options and are more likely to leave if they feel their inclusion and advancement needs are not met. To remain competitive and retain a diverse workforce, we must continue to adapt by fostering an inclusive culture and offering growth opportunities that align with the evolving expectations of a dynamic workforce. The following highlights the specific areas we've made to recruit and retain top talent in an effort to mitigate some of the challenges faced in the hiring process. Incentivizing the hiring process by strategically working with our labor union partners to offer recruitment and retention initiatives for hard-to-fill positions, such as parking enforcement officer, parking lot attendant, and tree pruner two, and proactively highlighting these incentives on the respective job postings. We've utilized many strategic approaches to create a more streamlined and inclusive recruitment approach. Some of these items include implementing the blind application process, and incorporating diversity-related questions into interviews to promote an inclusive selection process. Through the blind applications process, personal identification information is removed from the candidate's application. Thus, candidates are selected for interviews based on the experience, training, and educational background included in their education. Their application. Worked proactively to remove gender-specific language and derogatory terminology from classification specifications and city civil service examinations. Created a general intern classification intended to provide a pathway to help develop our local workforce and build a pipeline of workers for city employment. This is an entry-level classification designed to provide access to workforce services and employment opportunities and requires no experience or education to qualify. Sourced and procured vendor contracts that departments can leverage to conduct national recruitment searches for hard-to-fill positions, expanding access to qualified talent pools. Implemented adjustments to the application screening process for minimum qualifications to remove barriers for applicants in the recruitment process, such as requiring proof of education, certification, licensing at time of appointment rather than time of application. Allowing consideration of unpaid experience, such as internships and volunteer experience, to meet the qualification standards of the job posting. We are in the process of implementing the mandatory use of the offered step in the city's online hiring system, which is what departments use to manage their interview processes. This enhancement will allow us to collect valuable data on applicant decisions to better understand the reasons candidates decline job offers. To address workforce transitions and strengthen our talent pipeline, the city continues to enhance its outreach strategies and employer branding efforts. Some of the ways we have done that are by ramping up recruitment efforts by attending and recruiting at both public and private career fairs and colleges, with an emphasis on recruiting in community spaces reflective of the community we serve. We partner with Sacramento County Department of Human Assistance Benefits to provide community-based job talks where HR personnel can speak and educate the community about City of Sacramento job openings, the selection process, and provide helpful recommendations and resources related to becoming a city employee. Human Resources strategically utilizes our new social media pages on LinkedIn, Instagram, and Facebook to highlight city job posting by leveraging recruitment data to identify and highlight hard-to-fill positions citywide. Additionally, we advertise city postings through industry-related organizations, government job boards, and state networks such as Government Alliance on Race and Equity, Urban League Job Fair, Sacramento Pride events, and resource events organized by city council members. To maximize outreach within the local workforce, the city also shares jobs with Sacramento community partners, which may include California Black Chamber of Commerce, Sacramento Hispanic Chamber of Commerce, California Asian Chamber of Commerce, and Sacramento Promise Zone Network to distribute job announcements through social equity networks and to shareholders. I am also excited to announce the development of a new onboarding tool through NeoGov, the city's applicant tracking system, we will be using to enhance our hiring process. This tool is designed to bridge the gap between the moment an offer is made and accepted and the employee's official first start date, ensuring a smooth and engaging transition into our workforce. Employees will also be able to maintain access to the onboarding tool throughout their tenure with the City of Sacramento. In today's competitive job market, it's crucial that we position the City of Sacramento as a preferred employer. This new onboarding tool will help us achieve that by delivering a personalized and consistent experience for new hires and will showcase our commitment to innovation and employee satisfaction, reinforcing our reputation as an organization that values and invests in its people. It is important to note that human resources are limited and city hiring departments are responsible for directly advertising their vacancies to support recruitment efforts. In addition to attracting top talent, the city remains focused on reshaping a supportive and inclusive work environment that fosters employee engagement and long-term retention. That includes working with executive recruitment firms who support city DEI initiatives to reach underrepresented individuals and women to fill executive-level positions. HR implemented the mandatory hiring, uncovering unconscious bias in hiring and interview, training that all city staff who sit on interview panels are required to complete. The training is designed to help interview panel members recognize and address personal hidden biases that may interfere with hiring decisions and can potentially lead to illegal discriminatory behavior. Interview panels are required to be diverse in terms of gender, ethnicity, professional history, and background, aiming to bring varied perspectives to the evaluation process. HR provides training and resources to panel members on recognizing and mitigating biases, emphasizing the importance of fair assessment based on qualifications and skills. We have also developed the citywide comprehensive resources and guidelines aimed at ensuring that our interview procedures are structured to mitigate biases and promote equity. We leverage exit interviews as a crucial tool to enhance DEI standards within the city. By systematically gathering feedback from separating employees, HR gains valuable insights into the separating employees' experiences. This feedback is meticulously analyzed to identify recurring themes and potential areas for improvement and is shared with departments when it's appropriate. HR uses this data to inform strategic initiatives aimed at addressing any identified gaps and fostering a more inclusive workplace culture. The city is committed to creating a culture of balance and flexibility by offering supportive work options such as flexible schedules and remote work arrangements. Additionally, employees have access to the city's employee assistance program, CONCERN, which provides confidential resources to support their personal and professional well-being. Investing in employee development is essential to building a skilled workforce and engaged workforce. And the city supports this by providing thousands of on-demand training opportunities through its learning management system, Acumen. This is a strategic investment in human capital with a goal of creating a more skilled, adaptable, and motivated workforce capable of meeting and the evolving needs of the public. Equally important is the implementation of and enforcement of compliance-based training, which ensures employees are equipped with the knowledge and tools to meet legal, regulatory, and organizational standards. As we move forward, our commitment to DEI must remain at the heart of our workforce strategy. The city's ongoing efforts to create inclusive recruitment practices, reduce barriers to access, and foster equitable growth opportunities reflect our recognition that diversity drives innovation, engagement, and service excellence. From revamping job classifications and application processes to launching a new onboarding tool, experience, and engaging with community-based organizations, our initiatives are intentional and data-informed. But DEI is not a destination. It is a continuous process that requires vigilance, adaptation, and investment. By prioritizing equity and hiring and creating a workforce where all employees feel valued and supported, we not only strengthen our ability to retain a high-performing workforce, but we also reinforce our role as a forward-thinking public employer that mirrors and serves the diverse community we represent. In closing, AB 2561 reinforces the importance of transparency, accountability, and collaboration in addressing workforce challenges. By analyzing our data, identifying obstacles, and implementing targeted strategies, the city remains committed to building a strong, sustainable workforce that can continue to meet the needs of our community. Next, I'll introduce our labor partner, Ryan Henry, Vice President for Sacramento Area Firefighters Local 522. And I'm happy to answer any questions you may have before or after the presentation from our labor partner.
Thank you so much for your presentation. Welcome, Ryan.
Thank you very much, Ebony. Good afternoon. My name is Ryan Henry. I'm a fire captain with the Sacramento Fire Department, a 22-year city employee, and the city vice president for Sacramento Area Firefighters, Local 522. Thank you for the opportunity to speak on this important topic. I'd like to start by saying this presentation was created in collaboration with the fire chief and his executive team. So any questions you may have can be directed to myself or the fire chief and his staff. Vacancies within the fire department are unique because the fire department responds to emergencies 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, 365 days a year. If a vacancy goes unfilled, the ability of the fire company to perform its job is reduced. We fill vacancies in three ways: by hiring new firefighters, a process that takes up to 13 months. We use a detail pool of firefighters, then voluntary overtime, and finally, mandatory overtime, which is forcing firefighters to work under the potential threat of discipline. We have two types of vacancies in the fire department: vacant FTEs, which are ongoing and all currently in the active recruitment process. These are caused by retirement, separation, and promotion. We also have daily vacancies caused by vacation, sick leave, and injury. Regardless of the type and duration of the vacancy, it has to be filled every day. A quick review of fire department staffing. Each fire engine or truck is staffed with 4 personnel. We have 34 fire companies operating out of 24 stations and 18 ambulances staffed with 2 firefighters. Our total daily staffing needs for suppression and ambulance companies is 171 personnel. On any given day, a fire company can experience one or more vacancies for a variety of reasons. Vacation, retirement, injury, and sick leave all create an open seat on the fire company that must be filled in order for the company to perform at the expected level of service. We can only force a firefighter to work so much before the threat of discipline is outweighed by the need for rest or to spend time with their family. Working 72 hours straight in a system as busy as we are takes its toll on a firefighter's mind and body. Often, vacancies go unfilled, resulting in company closures called brownouts. In 2024, we had to close companies 152 times. As many as 4 fire companies in a single day have been closed, resulting in a significant decrease in the fire department's response capability. When you consider that 6 companies are dispatched on a first alarm residential fire, it becomes clear the detrimental effects of these brownouts. The mandatory callback of firefighters is a long-standing industry practice to ensure adequate staffing in times of disaster or extenuating circumstances. This practice has never been designed to be utilized as an ongoing staffing model. Over the past 10 years, you can see the significant rise in mandatory overtime hours as our detail pool has shrunk to unacceptable levels. When you factor in the call volume increase the fire department has experienced in the same time period, it's no surprise that the fire department, roughly 10% of the city's workforce, accounts for 34% of the city's work comp injuries. Before overtime is used to fill vacancies, the fire department utilizes a detail pool of firefighters who are on regular duty and moved around the city daily where open spots occur. These are additional firefighter FTEs above the daily staffing requirements. The detail pool fills daily and ongoing vacancies without using overtime. Currently, the fire department averages 23 vacancies per day, and we only have 12 detail pool firefighters per shift for a total of 37 across all three shifts. The total number of firefighters it would take to significantly reduce or eliminate mandatory overtime in the detail pool is 102. So what's the solution? Obviously, given the current budget situation, adding FTE firefighters is not feasible. The continued expansion of the single role ambulance program will allow firefighters to move back onto fire engines, support filling vacancies, and create an adequate detail pool. Local 522 is also in support of exploring the potential to expand the public-private partnership for ambulance transport. This will allow the city to meet its EMS transportation demand and help accelerate the process of bolstering the suppression detail pool. We must also reinstate the long-standing practice of holding two fire academies per year. Most of the fire department's ongoing vacancies are due to retirements and occur at the end of a calendar year. Holding only one academy per year creates a significant peaks and valleys in the amount of open spots. By adding a second academy each year, these peaks and valleys will smooth out, further reducing mandatory overtime. With only one academy per year currently, the spring and early summer is our most difficult time to staff the fire department. As an example, last Saturday, May 24th, we had 30 vacancies for that day. This resulted in 10 personnel being mandatoried and the closure of Truck 5 at 8th and Broadway. Our current staffing model is unsustainable. That concludes my presentation. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much for your presentation. Now we will do council comments. Is there any members of the, actually not council comments, but any members of the public lined up to speak?
I have one speaker on this item, Barbara Ram.
Hello. Didn't know I was going to be talking about this today, but just can't be quiet about it. So that was an impressive presentation by Ebony and very detailed. But I think we need to go one step further in that if it's a blind application process, maybe it should be a blind interview process as well, because, well, the best person for the job doesn't always get it, regardless. The most experienced person, the best person for the job, doesn't always get it, because people bring their own biases and whatever they think the other person is the best person. So we need to go more blind if you have, you know, so that's my two cents on that. The fire department, well, so there's four firefighters per truck. Make it three. See if we can live with three. Right off the bat, just do three. Or if it's a ambulance call and there is actually no fire, how about no fire truck go? And then see how it works. Like, give it 6 months. Give it 3 months, 6 months, and just see what we can do. Anyway, that's just my thinking on that. Thank you.
No one else?
Vice Mayor, I have no more speakers.
Okay. Councilmember Dickinson.
Thanks, Vice Mayor. I very much appreciate the presentation, and I certainly agree that it's very hard to generalize across the city on this issue. I think that Ryan Henry's presentation illustrates the point pretty vividly that the planning department or building or other departments are different than the fire department, and so you have to look at each case at least within the context of the department or the function, if not even in a further level of detail. But I think it is important that we are starting to talk about this subject, and it's one where averages don't necessarily serve us very well. So, for example, in your presentation, Ebony, you noted that it's 141 days on average time to fill a position. Well, you know, if I recall, Barry Bonds hit 762 home runs during his major league career, and Dwayne Kuiper hit one. Together, they averaged 381 and a half home runs in their careers. Not very helpful. And so it really depends on looking at the distribution of vacancies and the reason for the vacancies, which you were speaking to somewhat. But it doesn't obviate the need to do that examination, particularly in the context of the budget challenges we have. So I hope what this presentation today does, we've perhaps started this conversation a little bit in the context of talking about our budget, but I hope what it does is it gives us a platform from which we can take a deeper and more refined look at our vacancies across the city. I mean, one of the other things that I didn't quite follow was the calculation of the retention rate at 99%. If that was based on the numbers you gave us, if you took out the promotions and the transfers, you had about 1,100 separations for one reason or another. And if we've got 600 vacancies, you take that from 5,000 roughly city employees, that's a retention rate of about 75%. So maybe your math was a little bit different than mine, but that suggests a different kind of consideration as well. Bottom line, I think, is what you outlined as steps for recruitment and retention, and I think that those were all on target. I think that what Mr. Henry had to say about two fire academies is something we ought to be considering, but we I think clearly need to have again a in-depth discussion of what we do to recruit employees to the city, because we need to provide a level of service that we believe the community deserves, and what do we do to retain those employees once they're here. So this I think is useful if we make use of it. Otherwise, we've just had a pleasant little interlude in our agenda. Thanks.
I agree. And Councilmember Dickinson, do you want Ebony to come up and explain this retention slide again? Because I know you have the 99% and you mentioned 75%. And I think we just said 99% for this year.
Yes, so to calculate the city's retention rate, we began by identifying the total number of regular full-time employees that were employed on January 1st, 2024, which was 3,873. And then we determined how many of those same employees were still employed with the city as of December 31st, 2024. And then we identified the retention rate by calculating or by dividing the number of employees who remained employed throughout the year in that time frame by the total number of employees at the beginning of the year. So it's not just looking at the total number of employees in the city, it's looking at a point in time from January 1st of those full-time employees, how many of them were still employed as of December 31st of 2024. So we did that same exercise for 2025 from January 1st, 2025 to today's date.
Got it. Okay, thank you so much. That's helpful because I know we hear from a lot that, I mean, SMUD or other agencies continue to take our employees because other agencies can offer more money. And so this retention is really important.
Absolutely.
Is there anything else, Councilmember Dickinson, on your questions for her? Or are you good now? Good. Okay. All right, Councilmember Plagiebaum.
Thank you. Thank you. One of the advantages that we have when we're doing this now is we're going to start building a data set over time. So if there are things that we can look at, not just in our own data, but indexing against other cities, I'd love to see an analysis that, not this year, next year, looks at, what our retention rate is against other cities in various categories, and then what are they doing different. I think a discussion amongst us, not today, some other time about sort of what our goals are. Maybe it's 99% retention sounds good, but maybe that's not actually a good goal. Maybe we actually want to see more turnover in some positions to get move up opportunities for people and different things. Create some sort of liquidity in our employment inventory. If those are the wrong words, but I think you get the gist. If there are any recommendations that come out of this analysis that we can look at to improve, like average speed to hire or just recruitment in general, particularly things that don't cost money, because we don't have any of that. But the the stuff like remote work or if we can remove degree requirements or licensure requirements that are either unnecessary or prohibitive to attracting and retaining qualified individuals. Those are things that I think are certainly worth looking at. I really appreciate the comments about unfilled doesn't necessarily mean unneeded. I think there's been a discussion largely in the press that's conflated those two facts that sometimes positions go unfilled and that doesn't necessarily mean there isn't work that needs to be done in that space. So thank you for making that point. I really appreciate this. I know this is just a first pass, and I look forward to seeing how this builds over time.
Thank you so much. Councilmember Vang.
Thanks, Vice Mayor. Ebony, just really wanted to take this moment to say thank you for your presentation and really appreciate the high-level overview of vacancies. I do agree with Councilmember Dickinson that I think this is really the beginning of the conversation around vacancies and for us having to just dive in a little bit deeper in terms of the level of service. A few questions. One, definitely wanted to just center and highlight the 34% internal promotions and transfer. I think for me, it's a good signal that we're having some upward mobility for staff internally. So I think that's great. I'm just curious to know in 2024 on your slide, you had listed 886 voluntary separation, which is about 54% of vacancies. Do we usually conduct a separation survey when that happens? And is it possible that I can have access to that survey? Or just curious to know if we do that.
Great question. We do conduct an exit survey for every separating employee. That survey is distributed by the city departments. It's available online on our public-facing website. We also send an automated email once the transaction for termination is processed to that employee's personal and city email address. So it's distributed multiple ways, as well as text messaging in the future. So we're working on that piece as well. So we are constantly shooting out that exit survey, trying to solicit that feedback because it's imperative to be able to assess our processes.
Okay, great, thank you. And then I had another question, and Councilmember Plagiebaum touched upon this in terms of vacancies. So even though we have, for example, even if we have an unfilled vacancy, it may not necessarily mean that we need that job because of the complexity of the department. So I'm just curious, because I don't work in HR, but wanting to know, let's say that that's a scenario where we have a vacant position, but it's vacant because maybe we don't see the need for it and that resource is used for something else. Why would we then not change it, I guess, and say, hey, this vacancy is not really relevant to the department anymore. Why do we hold the vacancy as still a vacant position? And so I'm just curious about that, so that it's reflective of the need of the department. Or even like mayor and council, I saw a big vacancy, right? But I know that some of those dollars may be directed to pay for staff a pay for a staff. And so if it's not reflective, if the duties are no longer reflective of that department, why is it not reflected in the budget? Like, why can't we change it?
So the departments go through that exercise twice a year during mid-year and fiscal year processes, where they're responsible for assessing their departmental needs and mm-hmm. determining whether or not the positions that are allocated to the department still meets their needs. So it's at the department's discretion to do that assessment at that time to determine whether or not they still need that position. It should be reallocated or it should be eliminated in its entirety. Throughout the year, we work with city departments to assess those needs as well. So I get various requests from the departments on, I would say, probably a daily to weekly basis, mm-hmm. Where departments are saying, hey, I need this position to do this. Help me figure out a solution for it. So we're working with departments throughout the year to assess what those needs are, and then they're supposed to be making those official recommendations during the budget process.
Okay. Yeah, I'm just sitting on that and reflecting about that and just wondering, like, who determines that?
Departments ultimately with collaboration with human resources. So if they are putting forth a recommendation to make a change, human resources does assess what that organizational need is in respect to what the classification specification says to make sure it's an appropriate allocation for that particular position.
I see.
And Ebony, the city manager wants to answer that question.
Oh, okay.
Thank you, Ebony. Ebony's right. We are constantly evaluating positions, and it is maybe, for the most part, I think, as I mentioned last week, every department will tell you they need more, not less. So what they're trying to figure out is what is the right position to deliver a particular program and service, and so they're working with HR to figure out the right classification. We'll be honest, too, departments are saying, maybe I don't need that vacancy, and I know I'm going to get asked for permanent and ongoing reductions in the next fiscal year, and so I'm going to save that vacancy as part of my next reduction drill. So it's a balancing depending on when it happens, what's happening, but generally every department will tell you they need every single vacancy. They just might not have the right vacancies at that moment to deliver it the right way, because programs and challenges change and come up all the time, and we need to make sure we have the right people in the right place, and that is a very subjective, evaluative process that we go through all year with our departments to get the right people in the right place.
Thanks, Interim City Manager. I appreciate that.
Best practices around doing that piece, because I, for me in particular, just figuring out how do we,
and I get the that it's the conversation between the departments and HR, but I just wonder if there is a best practice standard for that in particular. I'm just curious. I don't work in HR, so I don't know, but I just wonder if there's like a best practice in terms of how we use those vacancies. And I'm just posing that question, that's all. So, okay, so just next question I had. I know that this is now a requirement because AB 2561, just curious to know, are there other timelines or deadlines that we need to be that we need to meet for compliance of AB 2561? Is it just this presentation?
It's just a presentation, and it has to take place prior to the adoption of the budget each fiscal year.
Okay, and are there any penalties for non-compliance? Just curious.
I would defer to the city attorney for that one.
Thanks, Ebony. It's new.
Okay.
And yeah. So I don't see any, thing that's set out in the statute that says what happens if we don't do it.
Okay. So it's just basically a presentation before we adopt the budget.
Correct.
The council member, I could add, though, as part of this presentation, you were wondering what best practices. You could look at implementing next year when this comes forward, having perhaps some analysis done or something for the departments to look at. Whether or not the vacancies are should be changed or adjusted,
or the ways in which we operate.
Yeah, that could be something you implement for next year.
Great, thank you so much. Appreciate it. Those are all my questions.
I'd like to just proffer that one of the things we're going to be bringing back as part of next week's presentation to budget and audit is just that,
okay.
A plan to look at vacancies as part of the budget development process.
Okay, thank you so much. Thank you, Ebony. Appreciate it.
Awesome. Okay. And I think that this is a great law that has been put in place September 2024 to allow for more communication and transparency in government on our unfilled positions and the full picture of what's going on. Because us here, we hire our chartered officers to implement the day-to-day activities of the city of Sacramento, and we don't see the back-end work of that interview and then that exit interview and the summary of what took place during that person's employment at the City of Sacramento. So I think that this new law that we now have at our disposal to have every year can help us as policy decision makers to really understand full picture what's going on here. And I like the retention rate for this year. And so now it's going to be something that we can use as a measurement for our success here in HR and recruiting. So I know you mentioned that in your presentation that you work with the different ethnic chambers to promote, you know, open positions. I think that whether you're buying something at a store, trying a new restaurant, or looking for your next employment opportunity, you always ask a friend or a family member. So using that as a tool, I think in like in HR, I think would be incredibly helpful, like a referral bonus or something of that sort for employees here at the City of Sacramento, because you always wanna go somewhere where it's a good place to work. And that's where the best talent comes from. Passive candidates that are sometimes not looking, but passively looking and, you know, get a recommendation from someone.
We do collect some of that information on the application. There is a question that identifies how they heard about the job opportunity, and we can absolutely expand some of those options. However, in order to implement something like that, we have to consider the city's budget deficit, but also negotiation with our union partners as well. So I would definitely take that feedback back and look at ways that we can implement it in HR.
Okay, wonderful. Sounds good. I see no other members punched up to speak. So we are good to go. And
I think we need to open and close the public hearing.
Oh,
we need a motion.
We need somebody to open and close a public hearing and move this item.
Open and close the public hearing and move the item.
Okay.
Second.
Second. Got it first and a second. Everyone, please say aye.
Aye.
Wonderful.
That was unanimous.
Thank you, Clerk. And now moving along, discussion calendar, Southside Pool, District 4. Come on down, Jason. Time to shine.
Good afternoon, council members. Jason Wiseman, Park Planning and Development Manager in the Department of Youth, Parks, and Community Enrichment. The item there for the discussion item, Southside Pool appropriation of the funding, is just a financial move to move some funding, some grant funding, so we can seek reimbursement. It's not new funding, it's money that was earmarked by Assemblymember McCarty, and it just has taken a while to get through the city or the state system for us to seek reimbursement. So this action is needed so we can reimburse the funds that are currently there, and the pool is now scheduled to open on June 14th. So
yay, about time. All right, sounds good. That's about it. And City Clerk, is there any members up to speak?
I have no speakers on this item.
Okay, and I see Councilmember Pleyebaum.
Thank you. Thank you, Jason. This is particularly timely as it's getting hot, if only it were open this weekend. I just wanted to acknowledge the work that Assemblymember McCarty did before he was our mayor, securing that $500,000 that helped bridge the gap in our funding is for this pool. And I wanted to acknowledge Councilmember Valenzuela and all the neighborhood leaders and constituents who kept this as a priority. I know everyone's looking forward to getting back into the pool, but I want to thank in particular Mayor McCarty for his leadership on this project. You know, all the work that you and Parks and the rest of the city staff have done, it's been a tremendous effort. So thank you. We all look forward to cannonballs together. And with that, I'll move the item.
Wonderful. We have a motion and a second. All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Okay, moving along to item 15, audit of the Sacramento Ethics Commission.
All right. So, good afternoon, Vice Mayor Talamantes and members of the City Council. I'm Farish Darawari, the city auditor. The recommendation that is before you is to approve the audit of the Sacramento Ethics Commission. The city created the Ethics Commission in 2018 as part of an effort to increase transparency and trust by establishing the Good Governance Framework. The program consisted of four parts. First, the Sunshine Ordinance, aimed at enhancing the public's participation and transparency in government. Second, the Code of Ethics for city officials, appointed officers, and city employees to promote open government, transparency, ethics, and accountability. Third, establishing the Office of Ethics and Compliance to be embedded within the City Clerk's Office to provide training and education component for the ethics program. And fourth, the establishment of an Ethics Commission to review, investigate, and consider complaints alleging violations of various city ethics laws. The overall goal of the Good Governance Program is to achieve the greatest level of compliance to city codes and policies, as well as applicable state law and elected official, by elected officials and all city employees through training and compliance monitoring. The Ethics Commission was established to provide the enforcement component of the framework. The commission was authorized to review, investigate, and consider complaints. And the bodies of law the commission has jurisdiction over include governing future employment, regulating campaign practices and campaign financing and spending, lobbyist registration and reporting, transparency, ethics, and conflicts of interest, and the City Council Rules of Procedure. It's important to note that the body was designed as complaint-based, so they don't initiate their own independent investigations. The commission was provided a limited jurisdiction over elected officials, candidates for elected office, lobbyists, city council appointed officers like the city attorney, clerk, and myself, and commissioners on city advisory boards and commissions. The commission was empowered to design and implement procedures for investigation, adjudication, and fine setting for individuals found to have violated codes and laws under its purview. And the city provided the Ethics Commission investigative staff support through contracting with an independent evaluator to conduct investigations and make recommendations on culpability and levies. The code also contemplates the city may enter into a contract with the FPPC for investigative and enforcement of campaign finance laws. And finally, the city provides staff support through the clerk's office. As I mentioned, the city code provides the Ethics Commission in consultation with the city attorney's office to establish procedures guiding the complaint intake, investigation, and adjudication of complaints. The procedures establish the contents that must be present in a complaint for consideration by the commission. First, the complaint should be on a form prepared by the city clerk's office, which is available on the website. The clerk, however, can accept complaints not filed on the form if the complaint includes enough information to engage in initial review. Second, the complaint must provide as much detail as possible, including, if known, each provision of the ethics law to have been violated, the facts constituting each alleged violation, the name and address of each respondent, and the name and address of any potential witnesses. And then finally, a complaint should identify the complainant. However, the clerk can accept anonymous complaints if enough information is available for the clerk to conduct an initial review. The procedures also provide the process for intake, review, and investigation of the complaints. The first set of procedures are passed in October 2018, established the initial procedures. The commission has made some substantive changes to the procedures in February 2021 that established the backbone of the complaint disposition process. There have been a series of updates to the procedures in September 2022 and September 2024. And the current procedures establish three main steps in the process. First, the initial review is completed by the Office of the City Clerk. Here, the clerk reviews the complaint and does one of the following. Either refer the complaint to the independent evaluator for a preliminary evaluation, refer the complaint to another city department, the FPPC, or another governmental agency with jurisdiction, or dismiss the complaint for lack of jurisdiction. For the cases that are referred to the independent evaluator, the evaluator conducts a preliminary evaluation, where the evaluator determines that sufficient cause to warrant a full investigation exists, and then they proceed with the investigation. If the independent evaluator does not find cause to proceed, a no-cause report is presented to the commission as an agenda item for discussion in a public meeting. And then the commission may accept the evaluator's recommendation not to investigate further, or they may still direct the evaluator to conduct an investigation. And then when the independent evaluator conducts an investigation, they provide the commission a report that includes a narrative summary of the information gathered, determination whether each ethics law in the allegation was violated, recommended action or recommendation that the evaluator conduct further investigation and report back to the commission, or a recommendation to refer the complaint to FPPC or another governmental agency. So this audit report identified 5 findings and makes 11 recommendations aimed at improving the city's good governance program and the Ethics Commission. We found that opportunities exist for the city to strengthen its internal control environment over the agencies charged with operating the good governance program. In the first finding, we found the city should consider conducting strategic planning to document objectives, design action plans, or monitor activities over the development and delivery of outreach and training programs and over the good governance program. The process typically includes initiating the strategic planning process, stating goals and objectives, creating an action plan, and developing a monitoring plan. As a result, the city can more efficiently provide direction, monitor the activities, or measure the effectiveness of the Ethics Commission and the Office of the Clerk's stewardship of the Good Governance Program. Our second finding is focused on providing greater resources for training and advice that would benefit both commissioners seeking to enforce and individuals seeking to comply with the city's ethics laws. We found that the ethics commissioners would benefit from additional training or education concerning the laws and regulations under their purview. They, in the past, have not been provided robust onboarding and training on the rules and regulations. And as you all probably know, many ethics and campaign experts stress that these laws are very complex, and that the laws governing campaign contribution and finance, and specifically, without adequate training, the commissioners may not have a complete understanding of the ethics laws and programs that are under their purview. And so we recommend the mayor and council, in consultation with the attorney's office and other care holders, determine the training curriculum for the commission. And then we also found that those seeking to comply with the city's ethics laws would benefit from the city providing greater resources to clarify and advise on the laws. The city has created the Ethics Commission to establish an oversight function to enforce the laws. However, the Good Governance Program, as it is today, doesn't have any support available by the city to help individuals seeking to comply with those laws. We found in our benchmark of other cities that they provide different sources and methods to support individuals. And these include the production of support materials like frequently asked questions and videos guiding through issues. Additionally, we found that other cities, they provide advice informally and in some cases formal advice to individuals seeking assistance. And so we recommend that the City Council direct staff to create a collection of information providing the guidance and to consider directing staff to evaluate the cost of a function to provide some level of advice. Our third finding focuses on improvements to the commission's complaint intake and reporting procedures. We found that the review of complaints can be improved by automating the complaint intake process. We found during the audit work, there was a complaint that was filed that, as best as we could ascertain, did meet the standards of information included to qualify as a complaint, but it was not included on the complaint log. And so we determined that this was a risk to the commission's ability to fulfill its city code duty to review and consider complaints. And we think that a reasonable control would be utilizing an automated complaint system. This would provide consistency through the complaint receipt process while also providing a greater assurance that complaints that are submitted are reported to the commission. Second, the commission procedures state that information about the identity of the complainant and respondents shouldn't be included on the complaint log that's distributed to the commission at each meeting. We found numerous instances where the names of the respondents and complaints were included, and so we recommend that there is a more thorough review process to ensure that the identity of the individuals is protected. And third, we found that robust disclosure of the rationale for complaint dismissal can help inform complaint review and discussion by the Ethics Commission. The commission exists largely, as I mentioned, adjudicatory body, leaving administrative duties to the city clerk staff. Those duties include the intake and processing of the complaints. And so, as I previously mentioned, the city clerk can process the complaints by either referring to the independent evaluator, to another city department, FPPC, or another agency, or dismiss the complaint for a lack of jurisdiction. There's several different reasons that a complaint can be dismissed for a lack of jurisdiction, including time limitations, the complaint is alleging facts not subject to the ethics law, or the respondent is not under the purview of the commission. But we found that in the original procedures approved by the commission in 2018, a dismissal for lack of jurisdiction was presented to the commission in a memorandum with the rationale explained. But currently, the information that's provided to the commission is a simple statement on the complaint log that said dismissed for lack of jurisdiction. And so we found that statement on many of the complaints that we reviewed. And some of these cases, they were frivolous in that they were clearly not related to the jurisdiction of the commission. However, some did require some more sophisticated analysis that included involvement of the city attorney's office. And so while all of that was proper and contemplated under the procedures, we believe that providing a little more information on the rationale for the dismissal for lack of jurisdiction could improve those processes. And then recent changes to the operations of the city's boards and commissions through the council's PNPE committee highlight some opportunities for the city to update policies to clarify expectations and consistency in seeking staff support and providing recommendations. First, we found that the city can establish a process for the Ethics Commission to formalize requests for staff support. During our audit, the council approved a series of legislative changes to the city code and council rules of procedures to streamline the operations of the city's boards and commissions. And under the new rubric, the staffing for most boards and commissions are borne by the city clerk's office. The new legislation requires the commission to submit to the City Council PNPE committee as part of their annual report a work plan for items the commission plans to focus on in the coming years. And we believe that the work plan should also include estimated staffing needed to complete the work for PNPE to make more informed decisions on the work plan submitted by the city's boards and commissions. And then as part of the legislation, the City Council provide the Commission with the power and duty to report to the City Council recommendations regarding subjects under its purview. The Commission has issued a series of annual reports that include recommendations. And during the process of presenting these recommendations to various legislative bodies, council members at committees and at council have provided some direction. However, the recommendations were not memorialized in any way, and as a result, the recommendations have remained unchanged. So we believe the city could benefit from establishing a forum for the presentation of recommendations and identify the exact types of information that should be included for the city council to make more informed decisions as those recommendations come to the full council. And then our last finding addresses the contracts with the California Fair Political Practices Commission, or the FPPC. The city entered into a contract with the FPPC in February 2018 to assist in the administration, implementation, and enforcement of campaign laws. The contract stated the FPPC would provide campaign law enforcement and interpretation, including auditing, enforcement, advice, education, training, and legal review. Prior to the contract expiration in December 2019, the city clerk indicated that she and the attorney's office were in negotiations with the FPPC to extend or renew the contract. However, the contract was not renewed following the negotiations due to an impasse related to a $55,000 floor amount that was included in the contract and the FPPC's desire to not include a do not exceed amount in the contract. And the city clerk stated that this information was communicated to the chair of the Ethics Commission at the time. But notably, the FPPC contract expired just before the city began grappling with the COVID-19 pandemic. As such, the commission did not hold any public meetings for about 8 months during that time, making disclosure related to the FPPC in a public meeting very difficult. Some commissioners, they have requested to discuss renewal of the FPPC contract. However, as the contract has been expired for many years now, the clerk stated that the commission's review of the contract is not necessary, and the services that were provided by the FPPC are now being provided by the city clerk's office and the city's independent evaluator. And meanwhile, the commissioners believe they should still get an opportunity to discuss the potential renewal of the contract. And so as a result, we believe that the City Council would benefit from a discussion about clarifying the Commission's powers and duties to review and make recommendations to the contracts with the FPPC. So this concludes my presentation. I'd like to thank the City Clerk's Office, the Ethics Commission, the City Attorney's Office for their assistance and collaboration during this audit. A management response from the City Clerk's Office and the Ethics Commission are included as part of this audit, and I'm available to answer any questions you might have.
Thank you so much. Are there any public comments for this item?
I have no public comments on this item.
Okay. Any questions, concerns? No one? Councilmember Dickinson?
Only to say that when we were discussing this audit at the Budget and Audit Committee, the chair and vice chair of the Ethics Commission spoke together and reinforced what they expressed in their response to the audit about the independence of the commission. They recognized that the structure that has developed over time doesn't necessarily embrace an independent commission. It's in this relationship with the city clerk's office and the city attorney's office and others that they pointed out. A lot of the commissions that have been established have their own staffing and their own resources. I think they recognize that budgetary considerations don't make that possible in the moment, but it might be something as this audit gets implemented, hopefully, in terms of response to the recommendations, that it's something that doesn't get lost sight of in the long term, because credibility of the commission may be affected by the extent to which it's perceived of and acts independently. So I think that's just a footnote to this audit in a way, but I think one that we certainly discussed at the committee, and I wanted to share that with the other members of the council. Thanks.
Thank you so much for your comments. And like Farish just said, the city clerk's office concurs with a lot of the responses and recommendations made by the city auditor's office, minus what Councilmember Dickinson just explained. So I'm looking for a motion and a second on this item. Make a motion.
Whatever motion you need.
All right.
Yeah.
All right. Second. We got a motion and a second to approve the city auditor's work plan for the Sacramento Ethics Commission. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. All right.
Thank you.
And are there any council comments? A, B, 1, 2, 3, 4 reports. Seeing none. Okay. Clerk, is there anybody lined up to speak?
I have one speaker for matters not on the agenda, Barbara Ram.
in. So I missed the 11 o'clock meeting, which was the military equipment report. Just bummed about that. But I just wanted to comment on it. I also commented on the Board of Supervisors and the County Sheriff's military equipment use report, which was so lacking, like incredibly lacking compared to the SAC PD. And thank you, Farishta and Kevin Christensen at the City Auditors. They did an amazing audit of that report. I was stunned. I didn't think it was going to be that good, and it was really good. So I just wanted to say, like, kudos for SAC PD stepping up, actually providing information that is required by law, as opposed to some, like the county sheriffs, which don't. And but I did want to point out the reason for military equipment use is, like, search for a warrant subject, high-risk search warrant, scene assessment. It just seems like a Bearcat, which is sort of like urban assault vehicle, for just kind of basic things, doesn't seem really necessary. And in fact, when I looked at one of the documents, it said that one of the reasons they use it the most is for arrest for a felony firearm, felony domestic violence. Like, these women are living with these men suffering domestic violence, and our police officers have to use two Bearcats and whatever else just to get this one person. It seems like overkill. Thank you.
Thank you for your comments. Vice Mayor, I have no more speakers.
Okay, we're adjourned at 3:20.
Or should we open for the closed session?
Right. Not yet.
Okay, just kidding. Okay.